sitting on my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Citizen.
Right.
Will.
Peace.
Losers.
This is my mistake, and let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
leisure,
health,
education,
focus,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by Brian Bokesa with special guest hosts Kaylee, Shabir, Josh, and Tanis. They'll be introducing their guests, Sabrina Peberti and Don Fitzsimmons. Welcome, everyone.
Well, thank you, Jim.
So who's to do the duties here?
I guess I'll
start things off. Okay.
Well, first I'd like to say that we're representing Amnesty International, and we are all students from Camps Regina Public. Camps Regina Public, just in a nutshell, is a very... it's an awesome thing that's introduced into Regina. It's an opportunity where all kids from the city can go from their home schools and go to different school that's offering other classes such as electrical or health sciences, cosmetology, and the social justice class that we're in. And I would just have to say it's been one of the coolest experiences that I've gotten to do. And I would just like to let my classmates introduce themselves after I do so. But I'm Josh Stewart Van Dusen.
I am Tanis McNeil.
I'm Kaylee Powelko.
I am Shabir Zahori.
Thank you. And throughout the program, we're going to read four myths about addictions and substance abuse. And we're just giving you a little heads up so you're not wondering what all that's about. But we are going to base our radio show on substance and illegal substance abuse among teens. And would you like to read your first myth?
Myth number one, overcoming addiction is a simple matter of willpower. You can stop using drugs if you really want to.
Experts have found that prolonged exposure to drugs alters the brain in ways that result in powerful cravings and a compulsion to use. These brain changes make it extremely difficult to quit by sheer force of will.
Thank you. We also have guest speakers here today. I would like to introduce Dawn and Sabrina. They are representative, or they work with the Coppell Health Region. Would you guys like to introduce yourself and your relationship with the addiction services?
Yeah, thank you, Josh.
My name's Don Fitzsimmons. I work for Regina-Qualpell Health District as the supervisor of the youth team, which is an awesome experience to be able to take our skills and experience and go into schools on a daily basis and offer some of what we know in order to help kids make some sense out of these difficulties that they might be encountering with drugs and alcohol. I've been working in this field for about 35 years, and so I've learned a few things, but I want to be very clear, I do not know everything. And the beauty of this job is that I get an opportunity to be involved in projects such as this, where clever and keen-minded young people are coming together to share their experience, and through that, I continue to learn, and that's one of the beautiful parts of my work.
Hello there. My name is Sabrina Peverty. I'm also an addictions counselor with Addiction Services. I have been working with the health region for 6 years, providing outreach services to the Regina Public High Schools. 6 years ago, a financial agreement was put into place between Addiction Services and Regina Public to provide on-site outpatient counseling to young people that are experiencing problems with alcohol and drugs or are experiencing problems with family members that are using, friends that are using, etc. Since that time, we have expanded our profile to provide at least 1 day a week on site, and currently my sites are Cochrane High School, which also encompasses Campus Regina Public, and also at Belfer Collegiate. However, I've worked at other high schools across the city in my time doing this work. Yeah, that's a little bit about me. Thanks, Josh.
Well, thank you. And what I wanted to base my part of the radio show off of is I think that preventative measures need to be taken into account in schools, because kids spend their days there every day during the week, and 7 hours at most. And I just think that if we educate them during the youth stages, they won't have to experiment to find out the bad things and the good things about drugs. We know that most teens take risks and experiments with different substances. What are some ways we can prevent substance among youth, Sabrina?
Well, Josh, I think that one of the main ways that we can help youth to avoid getting into the addiction phase of their use is to educate at a younger age. I think that the age of onset for young people to start using is becoming younger and younger. And so even beginning in the elementary school time and doing education around substances and how it affects the family and how it affects peer relationships and things like that could really help a lot in the prevention of use at high school level. Also, I think that positive role modeling by the adults around them, including teachers, you know, ourselves as addictions counselors, parents, and the community, makes a big difference on a young person's substance use as well.
I think in the purest form of prevention, Josh, is that we have to catch kids at an increasingly younger age. Oftentimes, by the time they've reached high school age, which would be probably 13, 14 years of age, the statistics are showing that kids are already using drugs, sometimes at that age or sometimes well before that age. So we've combined our efforts to help develop some of the curriculum offerings that are being put in place into the elementary school system so that teachers can start to put this information in front of kids in an informative, useful, up-to-date, and effective way, and so that kids are at least informed by the time they get to where the real pressure comes when they walk into high school. Again, statistics will show that kids generally start to use substances during that period of time at the end of grade 8 and before they move into grade 9. So that's a really critical kind of ground upon which we want to have good resources put in place.
Thank you. And I guess there's probably a lot of parents out there listening to the radio program wondering what they can do to prevent their children from using substances. What preventative measures can families take to, you know, stop their kids from maybe experimenting or going to substance addictions?
I would say that one of the biggest preventers of substance use that we can see in the work that we do is having open communication in the home. I think that substance use leads to a lot of secrecy and not a lot of positive communication. So if we can encourage open communication from a young age with our children, we can help to kind of support them when they have to make those tough decisions in school, etc., around peers around their substance use. I also think that parents educating themselves about addiction. At Addiction Services, we provide a parent support group that runs twice a year. That's 8 weeks long, that runs on Wednesday nights. It's a series that provides parents the opportunity to learn about addiction, to learn about how to take care of themselves, learning how to create consequences and set boundaries with their young people so that they can see that their use is becoming problematic before they get to that addiction phase. And so we think that that's really helpful as well.
I might just add to that. I mean, that's all awesome stuff. I think that we need to begin to train ourselves to look at how we're raising our children from birth. And again, if I could refer to some research in that area, the bonding feature between a mother and child is probably one of the key pieces. And I know we're going to talk about brain development a little bit later on. But in terms of developing a bond and a relationship between a mother and its child, that seems to be the seedbed against which all other sort of growth and activities in life will stem. Mm-hmm. So when we set that in play so that we have a healthy, positive, nurturing, loving, safe relationship between mother and child, that sets that situation in place where later on in life, when things start to get heavy and the child starts to experience the influence of school and friends and peers, then they have that home base, that solid family relationship upon which they can draw strength when things start, when the world starts to test them. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really key that we kind of look at that really pivotal and important early relationship with parenting.
So significantly, substance prevention against substances starts from the birth, from early childhood.
Absolutely, the seeds of an addiction is actually we can trace it back into the womb, where the first kind of brain development is taking place in the first 3 months, but of course the real stuff takes place after birth. That's when development of the brain takes place. So yeah, we're already setting kind of the seed bed in which good positive decision-making, good positive feelings about who I am and where I fit in the world and do people really love me, all of those key and vital things which are the correlation, if you like, between when someone might encounter a drug and then things start to go bad on them. If they have that root base in place, then they have a foundation from which to make changes later.
Well, thank you. And Sabrina, what do you think is the biggest problem with kids admitting a substance issue? Would you think that it be talking to their family about they're having an issue with substances, or is it the self-admitting kind of problem?
You mean in terms of their communication with their parents about their substance use? Well, I think one of the reasons why young people sometimes aren't honest with their caregivers about their substance use is because we know the number one reason why people use substances is because they like the way it makes them feel. They like the effect, right? And sometimes when we tell our parents or caregivers about our substance use, they may put a stop to that, mm-hmm. right? And for some of us, we don't want to stop that activity, and therefore we're not wanting to be honest about that use, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the main reasons why sometimes young people don't want to communicate that kind of stuff to, you know, teachers or parents or family members.
Kids generally don't see drug use as a problem in the beginning, and so like Sabrina said, it's a thing that is working for them, and they're doing it without their parents' awareness, and part of that behavior is about feeling grown up and independent and in charge of my life. And if I tell my mom or my dad, like Sabrina said, they're going to stop it. So they really don't see drug use as a problem. Oftentimes they'll see it as a solution, and the answer now is something they want to hang on to.
Oh, that's really interesting. And like coming from a high school student, I see that drug use and alcohol use, more specifically marijuana, have become more of a normality in high school and seems to be more like socially accepted for teenagers to abuse. I feel that this really needs to be put to a stop, like through the education system. What are some ways drug addiction can be prevented in schools?
Well, it's not something that we're able to actually stop. I mean, the substance is out there. It's not going away, and with particular reference to marijuana. It seems to be one of those subjects that if you bring it up in any kind of social context, you're going to divide the room in half. There's going to be those that'll say get rid of it, and there's going to be those that'll say let's legalize it. So we need to find some real rational place in the middle where we can look at providing teenagers with the best quality, I would say, research-based information so that they can make informed choices. The truth of that issue being that once a kid takes the risk to try using this drug, they're going to find it really meets their needs. And so they're going to find it to be a need-fulfilling experience oftentimes. And so if a parent or a teacher comes along and says it's bad, it's going to make you crazy, and you're going to do stupid stuff, they're going to say no, because my personal experience is that it feels really, really good right now. Now, does it stay really, really good right now forever? No, that's always a changing field. So it really have to teach kids about making good choices, making good decisions, using their own brain, and applying that into their own life experience. And we need to be as caregivers around them to support them if they start to show signs that things are getting out of hand.
Okay. And what would you say your opinion on how teachers can help directly towards students as a just helping hand, not necessarily from an educational perspective, but more of as a friendly talk?
I think that teachers just can help to be supportive to young people, you know, and if they have that relationship, then perhaps the young person would be more willing to disclose what's going on in their life. Say, for instance, if they have a parent that's using substances or something like that, the teacher can be very supportive around the family and situation and encourage communication. Right.
I would just like to add that I think the key to any effective change, whether it's in counseling or in teaching or in parenting, is the quality of the relationship that's at the base of it. And I think many of us think back in our days going to school, that we'll have an impression from a key and pivotal teacher from our past who was significant in helping us either get through a tough time or helping us sort out stuff that was difficult for us at the time, and we'll always remember that. Yeah. And my view is that if you've been fortunate enough to have had that experience, take that into your classroom so that maybe you'll become that person for the next kind of generations that come along. And we can help kids get through tough stuff if we think about it in a positive kind of relationship way.
That's very good. And Sabrina, is there any ways that students can, is there any things out there that students can reach towards themselves in if they fully admit they have a problem? Would they be able to reach out and say, I have a problem, what are my steps I need to take to get through this addiction?
Well, that's actually part of the main part of our job, Josh, is to help people that say that very thing. I mean, us as addictions counselors, what our job is to provide outpatient counseling. So part of my job is to help people to develop a recovery plan that works best for them. I mean, there's no one way that people recover from this disease, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the disease model later, right? But some people, you know, get involved in the 12-step community, AA, NA, those kind of programs. Some people, you know, get into positive sporting activities. You know, everybody's recovery plan is different, and it's our job to help them to create a plan that's achievable, realistic, and works for them. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about, like, peers or friends? How much of an influence do you think they have on the abuser, or how much do you think that they would be able to get them out of the abuser just based on their judgment on the drug? So if I were to say, I do not like the drug to a friend that's abusing, what do you think their opinion on the drug would be? Do you think they'd be trapped in, or would they somehow be able to get out?
So you mean if you're a non-using friend and you have a friend that's using and you're trying to help them out, how effective would that be? Is that kind of what you're trying to ask? Well, I mean, I think that we can't make anyone change unless they want to, right? And I think we all wish that we could. It would be really nice if we all had magic wands and stuff. However, I think that we do have an influence on everyone, and every time that we create a consequence for people, they learn something from it, right?
Yes.
And so if you set the boundary and say that you don't approve of it, they may not change tomorrow, but it'll stick with them, and it'll lead them closer to their recovery, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And how far do abusers have to be into the addiction process to get out? Is there one step too far kind of thing, or?
Well, addiction's a progressive disease, and we're going to talk a lot more about that as we go on. However, the more that we use, we know the deeper and deeper into this problem we're going to get. And once we get deeper and deeper into it, our tolerance increases, we start to have more symptoms that are leading us to addiction, the harder and harder it is for us to make changes. And this will all tie in really nicely when we talk about the brain development, because when we use that substance, the way our brain is configured will change, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, it gets a little bit more difficult to get out of it. However, addiction is a disease that's not curable. However, it is treatable. Mm-hmm. And so we can, you know, provide different kind of programs and supports for them to get clean and live a healthy life in recovery.
Don, anything to add to that?
Just very simply that Sabrina covered it very nicely. The changes that take place as the relationship with the drug grows, it's probably really simple to think about it, but actually what's happening is the young person is forming a love affair with a substance, and it's not unlike a love affair they might have with a boyfriend or a girlfriend. It becomes deeply meaningful to them in so many levels. And so just stopping or just quitting or just walking away is not that possible. Oftentimes, or certainly not that easy.
Yeah.
It's definitely possible, but not that easy. And so the young person, once they're in that relationship with the drug, we need to kind of work doubly hard to try to find something that's going to be as need-fulfilling but not nearly as dangerous in mm-hmm. terms of potential. So that's a big job, and opportunities like this to get information out to students and to engage in the discussion, I think, is where that's our best ally right now in terms of making effective change.
Okay. And do you think that school, like, directly correlated with the stress from school or extra homework or, like, the pressure of getting good grades to get into high school may push kids into drugs because they're looking for that happy place? They're looking to get out of the stressful days of school and into somewhere where they're not, everyone's not looking upon them as they need to get good grades and just lots of pressure.
Well, for sure. I mean, I think that when we start using a substance, we're doing it because we like its effect. However, over time, we start to use it because it makes us feel good and it helps us in stressful situations, mm-hmm. for sure. However, you know, we try to encourage people to find other ways of relieving stress, such as maybe exercise or meditation or, you know, mm-hmm. deep breathing, whatever would work for them. Because using substances isn't the answer to fulfill their stressful needs. A lot of times it creates more stress for the person because the consequences become severe from their drug use, right? And yeah. so it starts to become almost a cyclical effect because of their substance use, it's creating stress, and because of their stress, they use substances.
Yeah.
Sort of like a hamster on a wheel, you know?
Yeah.
And so then you can kind of just go round and round. So I think that, you know, people definitely do get into that because I think it's sometimes an easy way to kind of immediately, mm-hmm. you know, fill that need. However, we would always try to encourage healthier ways of dealing with stress.
Yeah. So in the long term, it's not the best, but short term, it's the way to go.
For sure.
Do you think that we could introduce things like, you know, say meditation or outlets in schools to allow kids to get their stress out?
Definitely. I think it would be a great idea. Actually, at Belfer, I know that they're developing a program of doing prenatal yoga and stuff like that to help the girls relieve stress. And so I think some of those initiatives are actually happening across Regina Public, and I think that's great.
Yeah, there's research out there from other cultures where the introduction of meditation as a regular part of a student's day is showing really tremendous effect in terms of their brain development, but also their capacity to deal with life's just basic stressors. It's awesome, but sadly, it's not yet happening here to any extent.
And I guess we should start summing it up here, but I just have one really final question towards our, I guess, panel of experts, if you will. What got you into the field of substance abuse and, like, prevention against addiction?
Well, I came into the field through the faculty of psychology and social work, and I started to work in the field. And throughout that experience, I was leading kind of a dual lifestyle whereby I was abusing substances myself, drinking too much. And so that I had this phenomenon of dawn by day and dawn by night. But when the wheels fell off that for me, I was looking for clearly a career change. But I was able to, and very fortunate through a series of events, to get myself into a position where I could continue to do this work. And actually, as part of doing this work, helping other people, kind of dealing with the same issues that I was experiencing, it gave me a chance to actually recover and move forward more successfully in my own life. So I've been doing that, as I said, for 35 years nearly, so it's been a ride.
That's awesome. Sabrina?
My journey has been a little bit different. I think I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be in the helping profession. I kind of was always the friend that everyone talked to, that kind of thing. I actually started my career in doing special needs work with Special Olympics and working in the Wascata Rehab Hospital doing some different work. I then started working at the ranch with some special needs, and then an opening just kind of happened at the addictions unit, and I just jumped on it because I thought it'd be a cool opportunity. And I just really got attracted to that field. And in 2006, Project Hope came into place. That was an initiative by the NDP government to provide, I think there was 90 positions added in outreach across Saskatchewan. And I was one of the social workers that was hired in that initiative. And so really, I think I was just a very lucky person that was at the right place at the right time, and I've been loving it ever since. So that's kind of my journey.
That's awesome. And we have another myth. Kaylee, would you like to, or Shabir, would you like to introduce that?
You can't force someone to treatment, they have to want help.
Well, actually, treatment doesn't have to be voluntary to be successful. People who are pressured into treatment by their family, employer, or the legal system are just as likely to benefit as those who choose to enter treatment on their own. As they sober up and their thinking clears, many formerly resistant addicts decided they want to change.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess that brings us to the end of the first half hour. Very interesting discussion, and I'm really happy with the way things are going. And we've got time now for our break, and we're going to have some music at the end of the break. What are we playing?
Ben Taylor, Not Alone.
Ben Taylor, Not Alone.
Really good
okay,
song.
So we'll go into the break right now and come out with Ben Taylor, and then we'll continue our discussion.
It's December and the winter's blowing cold. Just you remember I'll be warm when you come home. You may be a lot of things, but you're not alone. You're not alone. You may be a lot of things, but you're not alone. You're not alone. not alone, you're not alone.
That was Ben Taylor, Not Alone. This is Regina Community Radio, 91.3, and we are representatives of Amnesty International, from the social justice class in Campus Regina Public. Campus Regina Public is just a small little school that all other schools in Regina come from to get classes that aren't maybe provided by their home schools. Like, maybe some of them are electrical, cosmetology, health sciences, and the social justice class that we're in. And they're all available for grade 11 and 12 students. And in our social justice class, you have availability for two credits. You have a psychology or a law credit, or a native studies and a social credit. And I'm with my classmates. I'm Josh.
I'm Tanis.
I'm Kaylee.
I'm Shabir Zahori.
And Tanis is going to take charge here and take part of her radio part. So, Tanis, turn the mic to you.
All right. Hello. So I'm really interested in learning about the brain, and I was just wondering if you guys could tell us just a little bit about the youth brain and when it's fully developed.
Yeah, thanks. That's a question that's up for debate, and it's been studied to death. The latest and the best, I think, research that we've seen on it is that the human brain starts, obviously, shortly after conception, and it's developing throughout pregnancy, and then really takes off after birth. And then it continues to grow and change in response to environment right up until the research is indicating till the person is in their mid-20s. So at that point, we have a full grown adult brain available to use. And along the way, as an adolescent, we might be experiencing difficulties with drug use, and so drug use has an impact on the developing teenage brain. And that's kind of the reason we need to have this kind of discussion, so that we come to a clearer understanding that just because I look like I'm big and grown up, it doesn't mean that my brain is finished growing.
That's an interesting way of putting it. So right now we're just going to hold off on the questions for a second so we can introduce Kaylee and Shabir with another myth.
Myth number three, addiction is a disease. There's nothing you can do about it.
Most experts agree that addiction is a brain disease, but that doesn't mean you're a helpless victim. The brain changes associated with addiction can be treated and reversed through therapy, medication, exercise, and other treatments.
That was interesting. So there are a ton of drugs out there, and each one of them can do different things to your brain. But within the population of youth, it seems that marijuana is the most commonly used drug. So can you tell us a bit about the brain after you start using marijuana?
Well, marijuana is out there, and its prevalence is part of what makes it so common. It is widely available. It's grown. Some of the best marijuana in the world is growing right here in Canada. And so there's a whole kind of industry out there that makes marijuana, or wants to make marijuana available to young people, because it is, after all, a profit-making venture for people who are growing and selling. It still continues to be an illegal substance, however, for teenagers and for everybody to possess it, unless you're using it under medical conditions. However, for a teenager, when they experience marijuana, what they're doing is actually having an impact on a part of the brain that's not yet finished being developed. Marijuana usage adds and enhances the pleasure, release of pleasure chemicals in the brain, and the young person experiences an overwhelming euphoric sensation, which is pretty hard to convince them that it's not good for them when their personal experience is that it's overwhelmingly fun and pleasant. So it becomes, by virtue of its prevalence and by virtue of its euphoric offering to the user, it becomes difficult to kind of convince someone that we should be seeing this drug as a dangerous substance. So the court is out on whether or not it in fact is a dangerous substance or whether or not it's a gateway drug and all of that stuff. The debate continues. But nonetheless, what we see is kids tend to move from one drug to another. However, some people will just stay with marijuana as teenagers. But some will find that it stops doing what they want it to do, and so they'll try to explore that drug with other drugs and to have another kind of brain experience. And so the issue of what we're learning about the brain right now is kind of really, really imperative that we get a good, clear understanding through research about the brain and how it's affecting us. A healthy brain that works good, we work good. If a brain doesn't work good, we ain't so happy.
All right, so earlier we just heard a myth from part of our classmates and how an addiction is a disease. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why this is.
Well, addiction is a disease for a few reasons. We believe that addiction is a disease because it has a certain set of symptoms, right? Just like any other kind of disease, take diabetes, for example, has a certain kind of amount of symptoms to be diagnosed, just like addiction does. We also know that addiction is a progressive disease, which means that as long as we continue using that, the disease will continue to progress. I guess the third thing that makes us believe that addiction is a disease is that it's not curable like any kind of disease, right? It can be treated, such as another disease like diabetes, under the use of insulin, addiction can be treated using a variety of different methods. However, we are never cured from the disease, so once you have the addiction, it doesn't go away. And I think that's one of the main reasons why we call it a disease.
Yeah, I mean, the American Medical Association, 1935, declared that from a medical point of view, physicians, I mean, to get a physician to agree about anything with one another is a massive undertaking, but that the fact that they did and declared it to be a disease just gives us kind of a framework from which we can begin to develop programming and interventions and treatment services that help people actually recover from it. Once we know what the problem is, the solution starts to appear, and that was a groundbreaking kind of piece of legislation that helped us set the table for moving forward into treatments and alternative ways of helping people get well.
All right. So, about that, is it easier for a youth to become addicted or an adult to become addicted?
Well, there's a lot of research that shows that it is easier for a young person to become addicted, mainly because the brain is still developing, like Dawn had mentioned earlier, right? We know that our brain isn't fully developed till the age of 25, so when we introduce a substance at age, you know, 12 or 13, which is the kind of normal age of onset for young people these days, although it is getting younger, the idea that our brain is still developing makes it easier for us to become addicted at a faster rate than an older person.
And I might just add to that, that's absolutely correct. A young person, by definition, is dependent. They're dependent on peers, they're dependent on family, they're dependent on the school system. They're just, as animals, social animals, young people are dependent by nature. So it becomes increasingly easy to fall into the habit of being dependent on something, particularly something when it makes you feel so good in the beginning. And so by dependence is part of the nature of the beast at that point, and so they become at higher risk. We've seen cases where young people from no use to addiction in as little as 3 to 6 months. So this stuff is really hurting us in ways that, as the experiencer, we may not even realize that we're being hurt by the drug that we're taking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a scary thought. So in a few, like in, of course, multiple years in the future, do you ever think that drug use can start as early as like 7 or 8 years old? What do you think about that?
Well, actually, drug use is already happening at those ages. The substances are different. We've known for years that young people are abusing solvents, for example, things that are available around their home. They can huff things, gasoline, spray, aerosol abuse. So people are already trimming their brain to become a fertile bed upon which later substance use can start to grow. So that's happening already at those ages.
That is a scary thought.
Completely.
Isn't it? Wow. So, with all these young people using all these different things, can your brain fully recover from any of these drugs?
Yeah, the research, again, on that is very, very good. Again, it depends on the age of first use, how long, how frequent, how much, that kind of thing, and sort of what kind of portions or parts of the brain are being damaged as a result of the kinds of drugs they're doing. So, with all those things into consideration, if the person were to stop or receive some kind of intervention, maybe a medication of some kind, and maybe some other therapy and so on, and begin to really change how they look at their lives and getting involved in their own recovery, the research is very, very good that the brain can actually figure out how to deal with the stressors of a person's life without the aid of a mood-altering substance. It takes a long time for someone to unlearn something and then to relearn something that might be helpful for them. But it is possible, and the research is very good, that the brain, in fact, is very, very available to recover. And so it figures out other ways to make connections.
And I just have a quick question. You know, everyone always used to say, like, I can't have that kind of chocolate because I have an addictive personality. Is there such thing as an addictive personality?
Well, there's not a thing as an addictive personality without an addiction. So if the propensity is there for addiction to take place, it's probably already been kind of greased and fertilized and made available by a kind of a love affair that's taken off with another substance earlier. It could be tobacco, it could be alcohol, it could be chocolate, it could be gambling, it could be any other things that kind of create those experiences in their brain that we go, like a default, we kind of go back to them when we get into experiences of stress. So if chocolate comes along, it's the latest, greatest, best thing, and I try it and I love it because it gives me what I want, the chances are I might become someone who abuses it.
However, if I can just add to that for a second, we do know that addiction is also runs through families, meaning that, you know, if grandma and grandpa have an alcohol problem, you know, we are at high risk to become addicted ourselves because it is it does have a genetic component, just like any other disease does as well.
All right, and so in recovery of the brain, should a drug user, or say you're addicted to alcohol or any other substance, should they come in contact ever again with those substances?
It's recommended that once a person has entered into recovery for a chemical addiction, that they not run the risk of re-triggering the addictive cycle by, again, using substances. Probably the best research out there has been the experience of people utilizing the 12-step model, which is a self-help recovery-based program where people identify themselves as being alcoholic or addicted, and they recognize that they are addicted for life and that it's really never safe for them to use a substance again. The research on that is very, very conclusive, that it's just not safe for people to go back to the drug of choice because their lifestyle tends to pick up exactly where it left off, and they have that sort of degree of unmanageability.
Okay, so what are other types of drugs that youth or people can use in high school situations?
I think the most common drugs that I see in my work, I can only speak for myself, but the most common drugs that I see being used are alcohol and marijuana predominantly. However, I think that young people do experiment with things like magic mushrooms or ecstasy or cocaine. I know last year there was a lot of information that came out about basalts that has now been deemed illegal. Those kind of substances. Sometimes we see, you know, spatterings of pills being abused, things like that, but I would say that those are probably the most predominant drugs that we see in the high school setting.
And the research, again, if I could bore you with another little research fun fact, is that alcohol tends to be far and away the most widely abused drug in all age groups, including adolescents, and it is to such an extent that it's beyond all of the others combined in terms of its effects. So alcohol, legal drug for many over the age of 19, is the drug that is most widely abused, followed by marijuana and cocaine. And these seem to be the top three in the Regina Coppell Health area.
Mm-hmm. And so what let's just tap into cocaine for a moment, because we haven't talked about that yet. What does that necessarily do to the brain and development and all that kind of jazz?
Well, the brain, or cocaine is a class of drug. It's called a stimulant. And that this means that it kind of jacks up the central nervous system. And when we ingest it into the body, it goes through the blood to the brain. And it releases dopamine in our brain, which is a naturally occurring neurotransmitter that causes us generally to feel really, really good and happy. And so cocaine gives us that sort of immediate and intense pleasure. And it's the kind of drug, because of the immediacy and the intensity of its pleasure, the young person feels overwhelmingly reinforced to maybe want to try it again. The difficulty with any drug like a stimulant, when it jacks you up, there's always the downside, mm-hmm. which is the crash, or there's just the bottoming out or an ugly feeling that follows the drug use. And people kind of describe that experience as being kind of like a black hole or kind of like depression, and it's just a miserable feeling. So when I find myself in a black hole or a miserable feeling, I want to use the drug again. So it becomes like the cat chasing its tail. It becomes a self-rewarding experience, and that is the hallmark of addiction.
And can you ever go back to that normal feeling for anybody that's like a recovering drug addict? Because you said that you go down into a depressive state. When you stop using, is it difficult to come out of that area?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. Cocaine is an interesting drug for treatment purposes in that people who suffer from cocaine addiction have a very hard time getting out of what they call the depressive black hole, simply because it's very profound, and the part of the brain that's normally wired to give us pleasure, which is dopamine and serotonin, that has been diminished in its capacity to release, and so we don't feel pleasure from normal activities anymore. But that does come back, but it takes quite a long time after prolonged cocaine use. So the people who are struggling with recovery from cocaine, they get bored. They get tired of feeling so crappy for so long that they want to find something to make them feel better ASAP. And so cocaine use is what the brain remembers is a reliable sort of way to get that feeling back. So recovery for it is very high risk.
All right, so just to recap on what we've learned today, what should youth with addictions do to try to get help?
Well, I think one of the main ways to get help when you're struggling with addictions is to communicate with other people around you is really the first step of intervention, right? I think that we recognize and the research suggests that most people cannot quit on their own. Right, we always say that the weakest person is one who does it alone, right? So the more people that we can have supporting us, the more successful we're likely to be. The more honest we can be with people around us, the more successful we're likely to be. So I think the first step of intervention, Tanis, is to be honest and to be upfront and take responsibility for what's happening in our life, and therefore we can kind of get into programs to help us move further, whether that be seeing someone in addiction services or entering a detox facility, or maybe your addictions counselor can refer you into an inpatient treatment program. I mean, the opportunities are all around us, you know, in terms of how we can support these people if they're willing to change. But I think the first step is really to be honest and communicate with people around us before we come into the intervention. So that's what I would have to say, Don. Anything to add?
There is an old saying that it takes a village to raise a child, and that's really true in recovery and intervention. We as addiction people can't do it alone. We need the support and help of parents. We need the support and help of good teachers who know you better than we will. They see you for 5 hours a day minimum, and so they probably have a vantage point that we can tap into. So the more people we can get involved in the effort to help a child recover, the better it is in terms of ongoing long-term support.
Well, that was really interesting, guys. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. Just to finish up this, we're just going to have Kaylee and Shabir do their last mess here.
Myth number four. Addicts have to hit rock bottom before they can get better.
Recovery can begin at any point in the addiction process, and the earlier the better. The longer drug abuse continues, the stronger the addiction becomes, and the harder it is to treat. Don't wait to intervene until the addict has lost it all.
Thank you to the guests for joining us.
Yeah, I would just like to say a big thank you to, you know, our teachers, to having, like, to coordinating this kind of cool experience that we've gotten to do, and more specifically that our guests that came out today and helped us, you know, construct this radio show. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate this. I'd also like to thank Community Radio for giving us this opportunity. This is awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I would just like to say, for anyone that's interested in social justice or Campus Regina in general, you can visit our blog at crpsocialjustice.wordpress.com. And are we going to... We're going to close here with a song. It's called Whiskey Lullaby.
If our computer will yeah. cooperate here.
She put him out like the burning end of a midnight cigarette. She broke his heart. He spent his whole life trying to forget. We watched him drink his pain away a little at a time, but he never could get drunk enough to get her off his mind until the night. Put that bottle to his head and pulled the trigger, and finally drank away her memory. Life is short, but this time it was bigger than the strength he had to get up off his knees. We found him with his face down in the with a note that said, I love her till I die. And when we buried him beneath the willow, the angel sang a whiskey lullaby. La 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 la. La 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 la.
La 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 la.